If you have exhibits like this as a courtesy, you should have copies for counsel.
I apologize.
All right. Next case is Lucas versus Briley, 04-14-20. Is that Ms. or Mrs. Stevens?
Ms.
All right.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Linda Stevens, and I represent the plaintiff appellant Christopher Lekas, who was in the custody of the Department of Corrections when, in retaliation for a series of grievances that Mr. Lekas had filed in the summer and fall of 2000, he was the subject of false and baseless disciplinary charges that were issued by officials of the DOC, and he was found guilty of those charges without a shred of evidence. As punishment for this disciplinary infraction that he was found guilty of, Mr. Lekas was put into segregated confinement for 3 months, 90 days. Mr. Lekas was demoted to C-grade status, which had an impact on his ability to earn good time and participate in programs, and his commissary privileges were also restricted for that period of time. Mr. Lekas served those 90 days in segregated confinement. Mr. Lekas filed a grievance about the hearing and about the issuance of the charges, pointing out, number one, that the charges were issued in a faulty way. He was never given a copy of or notice of the investigatory ticket that was issued in November. He was never given correct advance notice of the disciplinary ticket, because the correct charge was not reflected on that ticket. Instead, the committee who heard the disciplinary charges went ahead and just changed the charge on the ticket at the time of the hearing, or shortly after the hearing, at the close of the hearing. He was never given advance notice of that or an opportunity to see that change before the hearing. Because of these flaws in the hearing procedure, and also there were flaws at the appellate level, as we point out in our brief, Mr. Lekas filed this grievance. The grievance went up to an adjustment committee who heard the grievance. Defendant Rodmacher was in charge of that adjustment committee. Defendant Rodmacher, who headed the committee, recommended that the grievance be denied. Now, DOC rules require that the director review the findings of the adjustment committee. In this case, the director not only delegated that to somebody, but apparently delegated it to the very person who made the decision in the first place to deny the grievance. And so Mr. Rodmacher, who was the head of the committee, the trial court, so to speak, went ahead and did a review and approval of his very own finding and signed off on that, signed off his approval on behalf of the director. Because of all these flaws, Mr. Lekas filed a second grievance, which conveniently got lost, and he did not receive any word. It wasn't until he wrote Defendant Snyder directly that he finally received word that grievance was denied. The entire series of events and the entire course of conduct that was undertaken by the defendants was taken in retaliation for Mr. Lekas' filing of grievances, his complaints about the medical care, or more appropriately, the lack of medical care that he had been receiving, and also because of the handling of his legal mail. The very bare minimum of due process that should have been afforded to Mr. Lekas was that any evidence, should have supported the charge that was issued against him. Some evidence should have been introduced at the hearing that would have supported the finding of guilty. Some evidence. In this case, there was none. Again, the charge was changed at the hearing, but the disciplinary rule that Mr. Lekas was eventually found guilty of violating was DOC Rule 310. And if you look at DOC Rule 310, what it says is, thou shalt not correspond with anyone who has said they don't want to receive correspondence from you, number one, and number two, the inmate has to have received notice that the person has said they don't want to receive his correspondence.
Counsel, before you proceed any further with the merits of your due process claim, we don't even get there unless you can get past the holding of Sandin versus Connor and Wagner versus Hanks that placement in disciplinary segregation ordinarily does not give rise to a protected liberty interest within the meaning of the due process clause. So unless you can get past those cases, you don't get the first base on any argument about the merits. So if you would address that, please.
I will, Your Honor. Sandin v. O'Connor did not say, as defendants have and appellees have alleged, that disciplinary segregation can never pose an atypical and significant hardship. I agree wholeheartedly that Mr. Lekas is going to have to allege at the pleading stage and prove at the evidentiary stage that his segregated confinement posed an atypical and significant hardship. Sandin does not say that segregated confinement can never meet that standard. The Sandin case says that it must. The cases that have come since the Sandin decision have made it quite clear that whether a particular inmate's segregated confinement constitutes an atypical and significant hardship is a question of fact. And specifically,
I don't really have any quarrel with the way you've laid out the law, because that you've accurately set that forth, but don't you agree that the proper comparison to determine whether or not it's atypical is to look at conditions in disciplinary and discretionary segregation and not, as your brief suggests, conditions in the general population?
That is a suggestion that Judge Posner made in the Wagner v. Hanks case. According to Judge Posner, it's not quite clear what the Supreme Court meant. I actually think Sandin is a bit clearer than that, but I don't think that the Sandin decision tells us exactly what to compare, although if you look at the language in Sandin, the Sandin court was clearly looking at that particular inmate's experience and how his confinement or the conditions of his confinement changed. In fact, if you look at the language of the Sandin case, the court is very much focused on what that particular inmate situation was all about. Recall that the Sandin case, the Sandin court, placed great emphasis on the fact that Connor had requested to be in segregation for some period of time, that Connor had his record expunged, and so there was no danger of additional time lengthening his sentence. They also looked at the particular conditions that Sandin had faced in that particular prison in the general population, which was under lockdown for a great period of time.
But the legal premise of the decision is that because prison officials have the rightful authority to place any inmate in administrative segregation for any reason whatsoever without any due process right attaching, so the placement in disciplinary segregation, unless it is substantially and significantly different so as to meet the standards that the court laid down, doesn't implicate a protected due process liberty interest. So the whole premise of the decision is a comparison of apples to apples. In other words, segregation to segregation, not segregation to general population, regardless of the inmate's particular circumstance. Isn't that the legal premise of the decision?
I certainly agree that that's the way Judge Posner and Wagner v. Hanks analyzed the Sandin decision, Your Honor. I'm not quite sure that I think that is clear. What I do know is that in this case, we never got a chance to take discovery and make a factual record either way. We were not able to make a factual record and present to the district court the facts comparing Mr. Lekas' confinement in segregation to anything.
Well, you did plead a whole lot of facts, though, in your complaint, which demonstrates that the segregation involved here is like any other segregation.
I respectfully, Your Honor, I would beg to differ with that. For example, in the Sandin case, the segregation that is described there, and there's not much detail in the Sandin case about the segregated confinement at issue there, but in Sandin, the court talked about being under lockdown 24 hours, for sure, but there really wasn't any discussion about some of the other attributes of segregation. The case law that has issued from this court in the years since Sandin gives us a bit more guidance. For example, in the Thomas v. Ramos case, there, this court found that it was a question of fact as to whether that inmate's segregated confinement posed an atypical and significant hardship. And in that case, the inmate was not in solitary. He actually shared a cell in the segregated confinement. It wasn't solitary confinement the way we would all understand it because he had a roommate. He was let out, at least on occasion, for various purposes, as were described in the decision, I believe, medical visits and discussions with the ward, segregation ward superintendent. He also, like Connor, like the inmate in Sandin v. O'Connor, had requested to be in segregation. So the Thomas case, I think, focused on that as well. So these cases are looking at, were the people by themselves in a cell? Were they let out for purposes? And if so, what? In the Thomas case, I believe the inmate had an opportunity for exercise in the yard 4 times. There was some dispute about whether the inmate had refused those opportunities or had been unable to take them, but the record seemed clear that he had been offered 4 opportunities in his, I believe it was 60 days, to get out, maybe it was 70, to get out into the yard. In Mr. Lekas' complaint, in this case, he has alleged no contact visits, no visits from clergy or access to a church, no participation whatsoever in certain prison programs. These are items that are not discussed in the Sandin case and in the subsequent case law, or are items as to which those situations differed, the Thomas situation or the Ramos situation.
But here, you didn't, even though you spelled out a lot of allegations in the complaint, you didn't even attempt to make any comparison in terms of what disciplinary segregation at Stateville has been, say, over the last 10 years since Williams and Thomas were decided, in terms of comparing disciplinary segregation.
Other than to state that it had changed and was different, that is correct, Your Honor.
Right, but not spelling it out specifically, which I think you're required to do under those cases.
Well, Your Honor,
if you set forth is a conclusion.
I tried, Your Honor, to give the facts that I had at the time, and I believe I have more facts in my complaints relating to the segregated confinement than were present in the Ramos case or the Thomas case, or indeed probably in the Sandin case. If you look at the Whitford versus Boglino case, again, there is not much detail. The court says there really isn't a factual record here that will allow us to make this determination, and so we're going to have to send it back. This is a question of fact. This court has said time and time again, this is a question of fact. We need a factual record. But remember, the Ramos case and the Williams case were both summary judgment cases. In this case, we never got that far. We were at the dismissal stage. And so it's a little bit difficult to compare that case law with the case we have at hand. It's a little bit apples and oranges, to use Your Honor's terminology, because we have a fully developed factual record there on summary judgment, which we do not have here.
Let me ask you this question. If we were to find that the record was sufficient that you've alleged and find that the conditions of disciplinary segregation have not changed, wouldn't the only value of remand be to determine whether prison conditions outside of disciplinary segregation have gotten better? Because you still have that atypical issue
I think that there's going to be a comparison. We are comparing Mr. Lekas' segregated confinement to something. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has not given us a great deal of guidance as to what we're to compare it to. If you look at the language of the Whitford case, and if you look at the language of the Sandin case, for that matter, and the Williams v. Ramos case, and the Thomas v. Ramos case, what they are comparing there is they're talking about the particular inmate's change in circumstances. For example, in Whitford v. Boglino, the court said, in the instant case, the record is not sufficiently developed for us to determine whether the conditions of Whitford's confinement were significantly altered when he was placed in segregation. So what the court is looking at there is, what were his conditions like in the general population as compared to when he was put in segregation? The same language can be found in the other cases cited in the brief, where the courts are taking a look at how that particular inmate's circumstances changed. And that's what we would like the opportunity here to develop a record about and to present to the trial court.
All right, you're in your rebuttal time. Do you want to save some time?
Your Honors, I will make a quick comment about Section 1997E, Count 2. I don't believe it's necessary for this court to reach that issue because I think it was unnecessary for Judge Gettleman to reach that issue. Because he dismissed Count 1, Count 2 wouldn't stand on its own. If this court decides to send Count 1 back to the trial court, this court would be free to tell Judge Gettleman you need not have reached the constitutional issue on Section 1997, and perhaps no one will ever have to reach it, but we're going to send the whole case back. And so we would respectfully ask the court to reverse Judge Gettleman's decision on Counts 1 and 2, reverse that dismissal, and send us back so that we can develop our factual record.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Stevens.
Thank you.
Mr. Illick?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Illinois Assistant Attorney General Carl Elis. I'm going to be addressing the arguments that relate solely to the state defendants this morning. And my co-appellee will address the PLRA constitutionality. There's really just three points I'd like to make. And my opponent argued that her client suffered retaliation, that there's some evidence, and last discussed due process. I want to take those arguments in the reverse order because I think that's the logical progression through the fact here. The first question is whether he's alleged an atypical and significant deprivation from the ordinary incidents of prison life. And I would suggest that what is damning of his complaint is not that there's not enough here to meet the requirements of Rule 8. It's quite the contrary, that he's alleged sufficient so many facts here that we really know what the claim he's trying to make. And so we also know that that claim won't carry any water, and so the judge properly dismissed this case. The paragraphs I'd like to direct the court's attention to, the paragraphs I think are most telling, are paragraphs 75 and 31 of his complaint. In paragraph 31, he lists the litany of things that he had to endure when he was in segregation at Stateville, and I would suggest that that list is essentially the same list that any prisoner on lockdown status would have to endure, or any prisoner that was on non-disciplinary segregation. He also insists, has insisted throughout this proceeding, right through the appellate proceedings, that he has a due process right in the correct application of the department's rules. And that's where the arguments about his appeal rights having been violated comes from, where he argues about his failure to get a copy of the investigative ticket, not the disciplinary ticket, but the investigative ticket. Those things were all provided to him under Illinois state law. But under Section 1983, he's not entitled to, in a 1983 action, he's not entitled to argue that the state law has been misapplied to him. He has to argue that there's been a federal denial of rights.
Well, he is alleging certain due process violations, and if we were to hold that he was entitled to protection, to due process protections prior to his transfer, can you point to any evidence supporting the key elements of IDOC Rule 310, which counsel spent some time talking about, the inmate notice and the recipient request prongs?
Yes, Judge. Once you get past an allegation of due process, if we assume for the purposes of argument that he's done that, then the question is has he received due process? And we know what due process is under the Supreme Court's decision in Wolf. He's entitled to a prior notice, an opportunity to present his arguments to an impartial decision maker, opportunity to call witnesses to the extent that it's consistent with the security of the facility, and a written decision. He's also entitled, and this is what he really focuses his arguments on in the reply brief, he's entitled to a finding against him that was based on some evidence. And he argues vigorously that there is no evidence that he's violated 310. The adjustment committee that heard this case agreed with acknowledged his statement that he had mailed material to a third party in Arizona so that it could be eventually delivered to a prison guard or a former prison guard. He acknowledges that part that much, and that is some evidence that he misdirected mail. Now, he says that that's not evidence that he has violated 310, which requires a showing that he had been told not to do this and that the recipient didn't want to receive it. But I would suggest there's enough evidence, of course we only need some evidence here, that the prison guard didn't want to receive this material and had told the department she didn't want to receive it, and he knew this. We can look at the ticket and we can look at the complaint, and from the complaint we know that it was Ms. Murray, the recipient of this material, that is the one who brought her complaint to the department and said this former person who I was guarding is sending me mail. So we know she didn't want to receive the material. The ticket, which is evidence at that hearing, talks about how he had said in his correspondence to Ms. Murray that he would not be dissuaded from writing to her. He insisted on that. We also know that he had been found guilty of violating 310 before. He had been actually transferred from one facility to Menard, and then there was this violation, and that resulted in him being transferred from Menard to Stateville. All of these things, now admittedly this is not the best evidence that she told the department she didn't want to receive mail, but I think a person reviewing this record could come to the conclusion that she had, and that's why the Adjustment Committee found him guilty of violating Rule 310. And so, in light of the fact that the sum evidence standard is not a very high standard, I'm suggesting that the department has met that burden. My third point goes to her claims of retaliation. Again, I can't argue that Rule 8 requires her to do anything more than to tell the court this is the claim she wants to make. And her complaint does say that she was retaliated against, but it's the way in which her complaint says it, which I'm arguing was a waiver. Doesn't put it in the counts, in the operative counts. She mentions it as background information, almost to explain why it is that she had been denied due process. The counts she did bring is captioned due process violation, not a First Amendment violation, which is what one would expect from a retaliation claim. It's not that she failed to plead a retaliation claim. It's that when the time comes in the district court to explain to the court why a cause of action is made by a complaint, she had that opportunity. She never said, I have a retaliation claim here, Your Honors. Allow me to go forward with that. In fact, she didn't say it in the post-judgment motions either after the case had been dismissed. The first we see a reference to retaliation, the first we see any legal argument about retaliation comes in the brief. And so it's my contention that the retaliation claim is waived. To the extent that you find that it's not waived or if there's any parts of the complaint that get remanded, it's our request that the court acknowledge the PLRA and order that the complaint be struck. My co-appellee will argue to that issue unless there's a question. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Leek. Is that Ms. or Mrs. Kaufman? All right.
May it please the court, counsel. With respect to the constitutionality of Section 1997EE of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, I do not think there is much here for the court to decide. This court has already held relatively recently that the statute is constitutional, and since then it's had several opportunities to revisit and re-examine the statute, and it has not changed that conclusion. Both in this circuit and in many other circuits, the constitutionality of the statute is a closed question. The appellant concedes in his reply brief that the statute is constitutional as applied to him, so long as it does not preclude him from seeking nominal and punitive damages. And we have made it clear that Section 1997EE does not preclude him from seeking nominal and punitive damages. We said it before the district court. The district court judge in his decision said that Mr. Luckett would not be barred from seeking nominal and punitive damages. We said it in the brief that we submitted to this court, and I'm saying it again today. If Mr. Lakis can state a claim for relief in count one, and if he can prove that his constitutional rights were violated, he can seek nominal and punitive damages, even though Section 1997EE limits his recovery of compensatory damages. That is the law in this circuit. So there's no dispute on this point, and there's no dispute about the constitutionality of this statute as it applies to this case. As this court and many others have held, the statute does not violate the constitutional guarantee of due process. It does not deprive prisoners of a judicial forum for their claims. It merely limits the types of recovery that they may seek. Nor does it violate the Equal Protection Clause. This court and many other courts have held that this statute should be subject to rational basis review. And it survives rational basis scrutiny because it is rationally related to the government's legitimate interest in curtailing frivolous prisoner litigation. There is no reason for the court to revisit this issue now, not in general and not in the context of this case in particular. So unless this court has any questions, we would ask that you affirm the decision of the district court with respect to count two.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Does she have any time left? All right, I'll give you an extra minute because
there was active questioning.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, the retaliation allegations are key in this case. The case law is quite clear that if actions are taken for retaliatory purposes, they state a claim, even though if taken for non-retaliatory purposes, they may not. And so Your Honor's questions about the atypical and significant hardship being a barrier that we must jump over, I think has to be answered by pointing to the retaliatory nature of what the defendants did here and say that because it was retaliatory, it does state a claim, regardless of the atypical and significant hardship. Also, those allegations were not waived. Pages 2 and 14 of our dismissal brief to Judge Gettleman, both of those pages talk about the retaliation. On page 2 of our dismissal brief, we said that plaintiffs believes and so alleges that the real reason for the investigative report was retaliation for previously filed grievances. On page 14, we said to Judge Gettleman, in the case now before this court, the plaintiff was denied a fundamental due process right. He has asserted that the constitutional deprivation was, in part, due to retaliation for prior claims and grievances he had filed. So clearly those allegations and that retaliation claim were not waived. And finally, I would point out, Your Honor, that Sandin could have done away with segregated confinement as a basis for due process claims. The Sandin court could have done that. They did not. They clearly did not hold that segregated confinement never works a significant and atypical hardship. So if we start from the premise that the Supreme Court is not going to make a decision that is nonsensical or serves no purpose, there must be some segregated confinement that does pose an atypical and significant hardship. And we submit in this case, Your Honor, Mr. Lekas's did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ms. Stevens, I know that counsel was appointed at the district court level. Are you appointed counsel or pro bono or?
Pro bono.
Right.
In for a penny, in for a pound, Your Honor.
All right. Well, the court wants to express its appreciation for you taking on these cases. The willingness of counsel to serve as pro bono is very important to our system of justice, and we appreciate your argument as well as the fine arguments of other counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.